Welcome to another week of Trashy Divorces. My name is Stacy.
Hey, I'm Alicia. Episode 11.
It is episode 11. What you got? What you got for our listeners?
But this week we are going to cover the happiest divorces in the history of time.
We needed a palate cleanser after last week.
Maybe after last week, but before that, a little bit of something amazing.
Tell us.
Patreon listeners, your prize packs got mailed out this week. Be on the lookout for them. One of our very favorite Patreon supporters, Heather, is a grade school teacher in jolly old UK.
Yes.
And she teaches fourth form, our third grade equivalent here in the US. And she solicited some opinions from her students about Henry VIII, which are amazing. She sent them to us, and I have reached out to our favorite young gentleman across the pond, Ethan. Our friend Ethan actually did
Some performative readings
that we are going to hear what Heather's students had to think about the episode that was Henry VIII.
Cool.
Here we go.
It's not often I say this, miss, but I really think he was overreacting. I nearly said that's overkill, but that sounds disrespectful. He did that because she had a boyfriend. Let's be honest, miss. Given what he was like, I can't say I blame her. You know how they should have known she wasn't a witch, because any reasonable person would have turned him into a frog or something. Funny that the verse came more common after him, isn't it, miss? Because those women were definitely better off out. They deserve better.
Wasn't that amazing?
Totally amazing.
Would have turned him into a frog or something.
Well,
really? If Anne Boleyn was a witch?
Seems like the most obvious outcome.
I would have found something way better to turn him into.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ethan. You're the very best. There's a big fat stack of quid coming your way.
Sure.
Thank you for being our voice talent for Trashy Divorces.
Or perhaps candy if your mother allows it. We don't know.
Yeah.
We can cut that.
So thank you, Heather, for the most amazing email ever. We were delighted by it. Listeners, we love your email at trashydivorces.com. And if you care to give us a little support, patreon.com at trashydivorces will get you there as well. Stacey, you had one other shout out before we get to the episode.
I really, really do. We had the very coolest thing happen for us this week.
It was pretty cool.
Slate's The Waves podcast, the feminist podcast that used to be Double X. Podcaster Kristen Meinzer from By the Book was filling in with Hannah Rosen. And anyway,
it was amazing.
She recommended Trashy Divorces as her, you know, they close with recommendations. And Kristen picked us. And we're so delighted.
So if you are a listener to that Slate family of podcasts, thanks for tuning in and trying us out. Thank you for the shout out, Kristen.
Definitely.
You rock. It was amazing.
Thank you.
So this week, Palate Cleanser. Podcast, almost no tears. It was me, y'all.
You broke that rule, not me.
I did. No, it was good. After the angst of last week, we decided this week to focus in on...
kind of happier.
Got you, babe.
Yeah, I did Sonny and Cher.
When does divorce work out for the best?
I think Sonny and Cher is one case. You had a great one.
Andrew and Fergie is the most amazing love story of all time, and I 100% stand by that. Happy divorces, y'all. Still trashy. Like, don't get us wrong. There's a little bit of stink lingering around the divorce, but all in all, a much kinder, gentler episode than last week.
Yeah, last week was tough. And
no need for hard liquor. No need for boxes of Kleenex. Just a good, fun way to go getting divorced, y'all.
Cool. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Let's do the episode then.
11 is great. Let's do this. Let's do this. Stacey, I'm so ready.
Alicia,
what have you got this week?
Oh my God. So you seem really amped, and I want you to bring it down.
Bring it down.
Here's what happened. So last week, I did Ike and Tina Turner, and I felt personally traumatized by the experience.
Bad.
Very bad.
It was bad.
In any case, then I spent over the weekend, I watched Lorena, the documentary on Amazon Prime about Lorena Bobbitt.
That was and felt equally as bad.
Again, you know, like, anyway, so.
You've had a tough week.
There was a lot. There's been a lot. I've felt a lot of things. And so this week I opted for something that just, I mean, it's like a warm and fuzzy divorce blanket.
Okay.
I guess.
Happiness is a warm divorce.
Happiness is a, I got you, babe.
I got you, babe.
It's Sonny and Cher.
I love it. Do it.
I mean, will you love
it? Vanilla.
I don't even know. This story is so.
No, this week is all about no trauma.
So one thing I did, like, just to give a little sourcing here, I did watch the, I think it was a 1989 TV docudrama called And the Beat Goes On, the Sonny and Cher story.
How is that?
Well, it's funny because it was based on his autobiography. And even in that, they portrayed him as some sort of like lightweight. I don't know. It was very strange.
He's vanilla.
And I suspect that's not quite the case. But all these people like crafted public personas for a long time.
Okay.
Like everyone we talk about basically has crafted up. Anyway, so Cher. We all know Cher.
Nothing vanilla about her.
Love Cher. Yes, the opposite of vanilla. Yes.
I love her.
Yes, she is mint chocolate chip. She is Rocky Road. She is anything but vanilla.
She's a badass.
She was born Sherilyn Sarkisian. I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly. Cher's parents divorced when she was 10 months old.
Oh, wow.
Her mother later married an actor, moved to L.A., and changed her own name to Georgia Holt. She began taking bit parts in film and on TV, and she was also scoring bit parts for Cher and her half-sister with the actor husband, Georgianne.
Oh.
And so as kids, they were like extras on shows like The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. I mean, so
neat.
She got the bug early. So when mom divorced again when Cher was 9, she kind of knew what she wanted out of life at 9 years old. Yeah. Yeah. Like she'd been in that circle since she was very, very little.
Does she know she can sing yet? I wonder.
Yes and no.
Okay. Talk to
me. I think she just lacked confidence. Yes, she knew she could sing. She knew. She's still very tall.
Oh, yeah.
She was taller than, she had this striking black hair. Like, there was a lot about her that even in high school, like the first day of high school, people still remember it. Because she was so stunningly.
She made that much of an impression.
She was also an extrovert and just really, I mean, it sounds like she, as a on a personal level, just had a ton going for her.
Wow.
Except that her childhood got really fucked up because mom kept marrying and divorcing and moving them around the country and would go through periods of abject poverty. And at one point, her mom left Cher at an orphanage for a few weeks.
Oh, my God.
And like, her mom visited her every day, but I mean, that is how...
She didn't have the capability of taking care of her.
Yeah, yeah. That is how insecure portions of Cher's childhood were. When she was about 15, though, mom marries a bank manager, and he adopts her and her half-sister.
Nice.
And enrolls them in a private high school in Encino, California.
Oh, wow.
And this, again, like, in her biography, like, fellow students have such a clear memory of her, which is a little unusual, because Cher dropped out of high school at 16 and moved 30 minutes down the road to L.A., where she was going to make it big. But apparently, when she was in high school, she was always singing, always dancing. She had, I don't know, in middle school or something, she organized, like, Oklahoma or something. I don't know. It was like, and none of the boys would participate, so she did all their parts because she's always had a weirdly low voice.
Way to go. Okay.
Okay, so she and a friend, like, head off to L.A. at 16. And she supported herself by dancing in clubs on the Sunset Strip and just introduced herself to everyone she met because she knew that at some point she was going to meet somebody who knew somebody and that was going to be how she became famous.
So she's unafraid.
Not.
Like the worst thing has already happened to her and she's just going to be unafraid and go for it.
Yeah, well.
I love it.
Yes and no, as we'll see. So in November of 62, she meets Sonny Bono.
Oh, Sonny.
Sonny Bono, who worked for superstar record producer Phil Spector.
Oh.
Who is a force to be reckoned with in this decade. And I'm not sure this made it into the Tina Turner story, but he paid Ike Turner $25,000 to go away and let him work just with Tina on Mountain High River.
Really?
Deep? Yes.
Just go away, man. Don't go away mad.
This is something that's going to keep coming up, though. Not necessarily from Phil Spector, but about controlling men in... in women artists' lives.
Okay, so, I didn't know that Phil Spector. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
interesting.
The Wall of Sound.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was a huge deal in this like early 60s, and I'm sure even later. But anyway, let's talk about Sonny Bono. He's 11 years older than Cher, and when they met, he was 28. She was 16.
Whoa.
Yeah. He was born in Detroit to an Italian immigrant dad. He himself had dropped out of high school to pursue his passion for songwriting, and he paid a lot of dues in, you know, these years in between.
Okay.
He worked in construction. He was a waiter. He drove a truck. He was a butcher's delivery boy. During the 50s, one of his songs was recorded by Sam Cooke. He also, incidentally, had an 8-year-long marriage that ended in 1962, just in time for him to meet Cher.
Oh.
And it must have been a bit of a thing. Sonny was 5'5". Cher was 5'9". He, again, was 28 and newly divorced, and she was 16 and eager to become a star. Although it's not... He certainly suggests that he did not know she was 16 when they began hanging out.
So, you know how it's said that like, people get dogs that look like them? You've seen the people and the dogs look alike. And then you see couples that you know just go together. Mm-hmm. There's something about their look, their fit, their... that they just belong.
Sure.
That is all.
Wasn't sure.
No, like it's weird because they don't look like they.
Well, I think for like later in their relationship, I'm pretty sure the TV networks invented shoes for Sonny that were, because there wasn't a height disparity on television so much.
Oh.
But yes. You're exactly right. Like, I pulled up Google images of them, and either they're seated or, you know, in some sort of, like, cuddly
sure.
posture, or she's either kneeling or he's on a stool or something. Like, but they're...
I mean, it's kind of... And I wonder if it's the shared... Like, they both persevere and know they want to have this career that, you know, drives them to fame. So
well,
maybe it's that...
So I think he... Pretty much, like, I think he was enthralled by her because she was young and beautiful.
Sure.
But then realized, like, holy shit, this person is talented.
Talented.
And I can make her a star. Like,
do it.
I can do this.
Let's go.
So, Sonny had connections. And so soon, Cher was a backup singer for Phil Spector at Gold Star Studios. So, okay, Cher, again, before she was famous, she contributed backing vocals to the Ronettes' Be My Baby.
What?
And the Righteous Brothers' You've Lost That Love and Feeling.
You're
among
kidding.
Many others, but I mean, those are... This
I
was...
I had no idea.
What a time to be alive, right?
Wow.
And meanwhile, you know, this is 1962, and so Ike and Tina are, you know, famous and mm-hmm. getting married and building their mansion, and like, this was a place... I mean, Los Angeles, it's... Of course it was, but... Seriously, this was a hotbed.
It's a swinging scene.
Of some of the like the most intensely influential creative strains in the world. Right in this,
wow.
you know, 5-year period. So anyway, Sonny saw Cher's talent and thought she should be a solo performer. But she was young and she had significant stage fright. So, not sure what it is about going to Tijuana to get married.
What?
But in 1964, Sonny and Cher go to Tijuana, and they have an unofficial wedding ceremony in a hotel room, which was not apparently legally binding.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, Cher had stage fright, didn't like being on stage alone, so they come back to L.A. and start billing themselves as a husband and wife duo.
Oh, my God.
So that he is on stage with her to sort of...
Help her along.
Yes. So he says he didn't have the greatest singing voice and whatever, and that's kind of true from... what I've listened to, but I mean, when Cher's next to you, you're not going to compete with that.
No, you're just going to set her up to look great.
That was what he did.
It's an easy job.
So over the next couple of years, they started to get some traction. They released some songs under the name of Caesar and Cleo.
Really?
Really? And the songs weren't hits, but Cher's voice was recognized. So she got signed for a solo contract with Sonny signed as her producer. And let's note that Sonny, as Cher's producer and co-performer and basically business manager, would be an ongoing element of her career for the next decade and how it all fell apart, basically.
Okay, tell me more.
Okay, so one cool thing that happened in 1965 was that Cher recorded a cover of Bob Dylan's All I Really Want to Do, and it peaked at number 15 on the Billboard charts.
Oh, wow. What year?
1965.
Okay.
Same year that the Byrds happened to have covered the same song.
Soon,
like, the two were competing on the charts.
You're
like,
kidding.
They were both just out at the same time. The Byrds heard Cher's version and loved it. And so instead of trying to compete, they told their record label to just start promoting the B-side of that record. And Roger McGuinn of the Byrds said, "We loved the Cher version. We didn't want to hassle, so we just turned our record over."
Do you know what the B-side was?
I don't.
I love this story. Go.
It's a great, and we'll,
the
you know what?
The Byrds are feminists.
I will find that out. We'll put it on the website because I've got links to YouTubes of both these versions, and they're really different.
I just wonder if that was one of their hits that them, like, doing a thing that was perfectly respectable in the music industry, which doesn't happen very often, if it turned into post-it note. Anyway,
yeah,
go on. I love this story.
All right, so later in 65, Caesar and Cleo switched to being Sonny and Cher and recorded monster hit of the century, I Got You, Babe. Mm-hmm. If you don't know this song, I strongly recommend you turn this podcast off, go and listen to it, and then come back. It'll be on our website, trashydivorces.com.
Please go ask your alien overlords what's wrong with them for not telling you about the song.
So the reason I want you to do that is because I am shortly going to make the argument that Sonny and Cher, who burst onto the scene just ahead of the capital A actual 1960s happening,
sure,
became a whole cloth antithesis of cool in an era where cool was everywhere.
Everything. Wow. So, oh my God.
I Got You, Babe was released in August 1965 and went to number one on the American, Canadian, and UK charts. Sold more than a million copies. It was one of Sonny's compositions, so he made a lot of money on it. Critic William Ruman compared it favorably to Dylan's It Ain't Me, Babe, while noting that it expressed an opposite and, to me, somewhat saccharine sentiment. Rolling Stone has listed it among the 500 greatest songs of all time. So wow. I don't want to, like, shade it too hard, but also I do.
I mean, it's a classic, but it's, you know... Okay.
When the song hit, Sonny and Cher, who also favored weird costumes as daily wear, toured to England on the advice of the Rolling Stones. The first night there, they were thrown out of the London Hilton because of these outfits, and the English press could not have been happier to cover the dispute.
Oh my God.
So Londoners who had been living in this sort of, like, mod, I don't know, there'd been this whole fashion the musical era, so they were just like, oh my God, look, it's something new. And so they were sold on bell bottoms, fringe, ruffles, fur vests, and bold yet unattractive colors, as well as matching outfits that Sonny and Cher were known
to. Can we say mustard green?
Yes, that's exactly it. Like, I'm all for letting your
orange,
freak flag fly, but
some Peridot. Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, in fairness, what was happening is that Sonny and Cher were inventing 70s fashion in the 60s. Like, that's the generous...
Trendsetters.
Wait, yes, trendsetters. That's the generous way to view it. The fact that this was a horrible fashion choice, we'll just disregard that because it really caught on. Over the next few years...
This is amazing.
It's amazing. They landed 10 songs on the top 40 charts in the U.S. They had 5 top 10 singles. Cher kept up with her solo career, releasing albums in 66 and 67.
Wow.
And then something amazing happened.
What happens?
Though it was late in the decade, at long last, the 1960s fell upon the earth, and titans like The Doors, The Who, and Jimi Hendrix roamed the land, launching transgressive vibes and an entire countercultural revolution through giant Marshall stacks and muddy music festivals. It was the era of sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah.
And Sonny and Cher were monogamous, married,
Vanilla. Didn't
do drugs.
They did not belong in this.
Sonny did not belong in this.
Oh.
Cher had been 16 in 1962, so now here in 19...
She's a little more
in
the culture.
In her early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
In Los Angeles, she's toured with me. Like,
let's get hip to the vibe, yo.
She would have been way fine with all of this. As far as the public was concerned, like, they just stopped being relevant. And so their music stopped hitting the charts. Their record label, Atco, dropped them, and then Cher's independent record label dropped her.
Oh, no.
But Atco came back to Cher and said, hey, we have an idea, and I'm pretty sure this is a a soul album. I haven't heard it, which I feel bad about, because it is arguably the finest album of her career, according to critics today. So this album was called 3614 Jackson Highway, and Atco wanted Cher to sing it on the condition that Sonny not produce it.
Oh.
Just Cher. So it, you know, it came out. It was apparently fantastic. I don't think it was a commercial success, but it was exceptional, apparently. And Sonny was furious and refused to let Cher work with Atco anymore.
But my wife did something great, but now I'm going to stop
without
her.
Me. Man, I'm... Sonny.
Wow.
Yeah. So
he's not the birds, is he?
Of this period, Cher has said, I loved the new sound of Led Zeppelin, Eric Clapton, the electric guitar oriented bands. Left to myself, I would have changed with the times because the music really turned me on, but Sonny didn't like it. And that was that. Because he wrote their songs. Like, he was the business manager.
Her second husband makes so much more sense to me now, but go ahead. This is great. Yeah.
But that was tumultuous, too. Anyway,
But way hipper on the scene.
For sure.
Come on, let's talk about some current tunes.
So that's kind of what was at the heart of their eventual breakup, though that was years away. Also, Sonny had some affairs around this time.
Oh, no.
But also, on the one hand, Sonny was cheating. On the other hand, Cher became pregnant. So once Chastity, now Chaz Bono, was born in 1969, they got legally married.
Oh, well, good on them.
Trying to put it
that
back
Tijuana
together.
That Tijuana thing didn't stick.
It wasn't legal. Oh, my God. And according to the movie, I'm pretty sure they got married in Vegas, where Cher, like, never wanted to be performing with Sonny. Like, the movie was
weird,
distressing. Okay, and so why did they name their child Chastity?
Why?
Funny story.
Tell me.
Okay, so they couldn't put music on the charts to save their lives at this point. They were increasingly irrelevant in the public mind. They were just flailing.
Sure.
And so Sonny decided that the way that they could save their careers and their marriage was for him to write a movie starring Cher. Not to go to studios and be like, hey, what great scripts do you have?
But he'll just do it for her.
He'll just do it for her. Like, this is so, like, he wrote all the songs, and then he's like, you know what? We'll switch to movies. I'll write you a movie.
You know, I've never really associated this much toxic masculinity with Sonny Bono before.
I know, right?
carry on.
Okay, so Sonny did not star in it. He did not direct it. Like, they brought in an avant-garde director or something.
Okay.
And they made this movie called Chastity, which... Sonny spent $500,000 on. He mortgaged their house.
Oh, my God.
And when this thing bombed the way that it was
probably going to start with,
it left them $190,000 in debt in 1969.
No, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. So, all right. So we've got Sonny now in his mid-30s, working his ass off to create a career for his wife, all the while smothering her and creating more and more misery in their relationship.
And putting roadblocks in her way of her actually having a fucking career.
For sure.
Jeez.
Like, yes, like just preventing her from having other, like,
just get
creative,
out of my way, man.
Creative collaborators and, like, any other vision of what Cher could be was not allowable. And he just... So eventually he creates this nightclub act.
Of course he does.
And apparently by this point Cher was miserable
over it.
And I mean, how happy could he be with his wife? I mean, so they were both pretty remarkably miserable.
So what year is this?
This is going to be 1970 or 1971.
Okay, so she is mid-20s.
Yeah.
And he's now hitting midlife crisis. He's 40. I mean, 11 years older, like, he's coming up on that time.
Okay. Yeah, pretty much.
I wanted to set their ages in my mind as before the deluge.
Yeah, and I will say, until I started looking at it, I didn't realize he was that much older.
I didn't either.
Partly because the persona, he was not the dominant character in
the act.
In the act.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting. Anyway, so they take this nightclub act to a nightclub and start like doing it. And like, it was so bad that the audience starts heckling them. And Cher starts heckling back. And Sonny starts like admonishing Cher for heckling the audience. And Cher starts heckling Sonny. And soon the entire room is laughing its ass off.
Because it's now turned into a comedy
act. Now it's turned into a comedy act.
Inadvertently.
Yes. Accidentally, this thing ended up being very successful. And TV bookers...
Sounds like trashy divorce.
TV bookers took notice. And so soon they're co-hosting for Merv Griffith? Griffin?
Whatever. Merv Griffin, yeah.
That guy.
Okay. Oh my God. In this weird comedy act.
Thus did Sonny and Cher survive their career near-death experience. But like these patterns of control and these fault lines, they don't go away. So in 1971, CBS unveiled the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour.
Fantastic.
And it was a big hit. It was a variety show featuring music and comedy skits. There was a big like supporting cast of writer's room, the whole thing. And what typified it was Cher's just deadpan zinging of Sonny all the time. And truth be told, I mean, he didn't write all of the jokes because they had a team of writers.
Right.
But he sort of supervised that process as far as I can tell. And so basically he wrote all of these put downs that Cher was like, it was a very strange thing that was happening.
So she couldn't even enjoy the release of, oh, I get to vent out some of the frustration I feel in this partnership.
Yeah, I don't think she...
If you're writing what I'm allowed to diss on you for.
Yeah, that I think that was... At the same time, again, huge hit, nominated for 15 Emmys during its, like, I think 3-year run. It won one.
Holy smokes.
And it gave Sonny and Cher a platform to relaunch their music career. And it goes so well, let me tell you. All right, so the marriage was in deep...
Because now they've caught up with their clothes. It's the 70s.
Yeah, the marriage was in deep trouble. However, Cap Records signed them, and Sonny wrote what he thought was a poignant and topical song about Vietnam and had Cher record. He was just never quite in step with where things were. So he writes the song he thinks will really like land Cher in the middle of the cultural conversation. And in fact, like radio stations won't even play it because they said it wasn't commercial enough.
Get in the zone, man.
But like Cap had just given them a bunch of money to join the label.
Great.
So they bring in a guy named Snuff Garrett, and he's going to write the Sonny and Cher ship. So he sits down with Cher, and I think, I don't know who wrote this song, but I don't think Sonny did. So he has Cher record her first U.S. solo number one single, Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves.
Yeah.
Do you know? Okay. Yeah. I listened to this song today. I don't think I've heard this since I was a kid, and
really?
It's really good.
It's a good song.
It's a really good song. It'll be on our website. And it's been hailed as one of the 20th century's greatest songs. The second single, I guess the B-side of it, was called The Way of Love. That hit number 7.
Nice.
And then she released an album with Garrett called Foxy Lady. Sonny lost
feels
his
great.
Shit.
Oh.
Gets into it with Garrett until Garrett is like, you know what? Fuck you guys. And he's got like,
I'm out.
So, Sonny takes the reins again. And so just as Cher was like actually
getting successful.
Yes, and building a creative niche of her own, Sonny's like, you know what you need to do? You need to record an album of standards. So she did. And it flopped. So it turns out that Sonny and Cher had been maintaining the appearance of domestic tranquility since at least 1972. And in February of 74, he filed for separation from her, citing irreconcilable differences.
It's over.
Cher was not about to let him have the last word, though.
Oh, goody.
And a week later, she filed for divorce on the grounds of involuntary servitude.
What? Involuntary servitude?
Yeah, slavery. So she said, and this is probably true, that he had withheld earnings from her. He had signed contracts, locking her into stuff she didn't want to do. And otherwise, just, like, he
controlling
he was controlling her career in a way that she didn't want and wasn't being appropriately compensated for, and like the whole thing.
Oh my God.
He was incensed because he thought the world would look at that and think Sonny Bono kept Cher in slavery, which
that's what the world.
I think in the moment that is how she felt. I think she got over that pretty quickly. But yeah, I think right then, because also I'm not sure when her affair with David Geffen began.
Okay.
But there was an affair with David Geffen.
Sure.
Certainly during the divorce and possibly before. Okay. The movie implies it started before, like that maybe it was one of the triggering events.
Okay.
So about the end. All right. For details on the divorce itself, I found a very cool site called blankonblank.org that seems to be defunct now, but had like cool animations that go with profiles of famous people, David Bowie.
Okay.
And so for this one, writer Jesse Wright Mendoza was given access to hours of unedited audio from a 1999 interview with Cher by a reporter named Benjamin Svetke.
Oh, wow.
So, overview, the divorce took about a year and a half, and the big issues of contention were money, obviously, and custody of Chastity, now Chaz. Cher eventually won custody. The divorce was finalized in June of 75. Of the divorce, Cher said, I went to him and said, look, break the contract. Let us drop a new contract. Make it 50-50. You can't tell me what to do anymore. I'm 27 years old. You can just not tell me what to do, and he wouldn't do it, and he just didn't count on how tough I could be, because I never argued with him.
Good on you,
I don't
sister.
Think we had more than three arguments in 11 years.
Oh, my God.
So once the divorce was happening, she said he was crushed because he wasn't going to be Sonny of Sonny and Cher anymore. That's what hurt him. That's what really hurt him, and that was sad because he loved it more than I did, really, but he wouldn't give me my freedom. So obviously Cher went on to be Cher.
Cher.
Her career's had notable ups and downs in the decades since, but she's always had a knack for reinvention and adaptation. And she, you know, went disco when disco was king, and then rock and roll when rock and roll was king.
Resilient.
She's made her mark in films like Silkwood. She was nominated for Best Supporting Actress Oscar, and she won the Best Supporting Actress at the Golden Globes for that.
Yeah.
She was in Mask, The Witches of Eastwick, and perhaps most notably, Moonstruck, one of the best movies ever. She's had genuinely monster hits like If I Could Turn Back Time and Believe. And her voice is undoubtedly one of the most recognizable in the world.
Most assuredly.
In 2018, she starred in Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, and contributed covers of two ABBA songs for the soundtrack, Fernando and Super Trooper.
Oh, I love Fernando. And then
I love
that song.
I don't know if you knew this, but this is what I'm buying after we finish recording today.
Okay, great.
Release an album of ABBA covers called Dancing Queen.
No way.
Which I didn't know about.
100%.
100%
in.
Basically, at this point in her life, Cher can do whatever the fuck she wants to do, and we're going to goddamn well love it.
Yeah, we are. Done. Done and done.
So Sonny struggled for a while after the divorce, but really like just kept keeping on, which is what he does. Like,
and the beat goes on.
Seriously. Yeah. So he tried to launched like a similar TV show but without Cher, and that didn't work. There was a relaunch of the Sonny and Cher show a few years later, and that
with them divorced?
Yeah.
And that, okay.
That didn't work. I think it ran for two seasons. But that didn't work either. He and Cher were on bad terms for a while, but I think within maybe a year or so of the divorce he opened a restaurant in Palm Springs. Cher attended the opening.
Oh nice.
And that sort of because again they had Chaz. They like And they had all this history, like,
yeah,
they warmed back up to some degree. She always said that they just always had a weird relationship, you know, during the marriage, after the marriage. It was just,
but like once the raw wound heals
right,
of the breakup,
right. And she had married Greg Allman, I think, mm-hmm. at that point. So Sonny did a lot of TV and film work from the 70s forward. He appeared on things like The Love Boat. He was in Airplane 2, John Waters' Hairspray.
Really?
Lois and Clark, the Superman TV show.
Yeah. I didn't know he was in Hairspray.
Yeah, he was even in an episode of The Golden Girls.
Oh, my geez.
One of his interests was apparently opening restaurants. And because of all the red tape he found in Palm Springs, where he lived.
I have a new career.
He ran for mayor. And he won.
Yeah, he did.
So he was the Republican mayor of Palm Springs for 4 years. He ran for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate in 92. He lost to a more conservative Republican, who Barbara Boxer then stomped. He was ultimately elected to the U.S. House in 94. And he served there until January of 1998.
Wow.
When he was killed by a tree.
Yeah.
In a skiing accident in Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, that was sad.
Yeah. It really, yeah. I mean, yeah, I remember that, and it was sad. His fourth and then current wife, Mary Bono, was appointed to fill his congressional seat, and she apparently did great and continued to be reelected until 2012.
Oh, mm-hmm. Super nice.
Interestingly, Palm Springs today,
yeah,
all of its elected government is gay.
Fantastic.
The congressional seat is held by, I think, a Latina Democrat.
Oh, my God.
Like, it's funny to, like, fast forward.
Do you think that Sonny would be a Republican today?
Okay, for Chaz's sake.
Let's hope so.
Let's hope not.
I mean, no, that's exactly right. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's hope he would have changed his party.
It's tough to imagine. But I don't know. I mean, he had some very traditionalist views about the world.
Yeah.
He had a song called, like, The Revolution Kind, and the lyrics were very much like, you know, a man can express his opinion without being the revolution kind. Just very counterculture.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so that's kind of always who he was.
Huh.
And again, his dad was an Italian immigrant, so he was, I think, raised in a very traditional mindset about the world. Anyway, so a year after his death, for this blank on blank piece. So this is how Cher described their early relationship.
Okay.
He was like the father. You know how you can be frightened of your father even if he doesn't ever do anything? It wasn't like, I mean, he never hit me. He never even really yelled at me. He could be tough, though. He could just be real tough in that kind of horrible, tough Sicilian way. I couldn't stand on my own two feet and talk back to him. That was my problem. I could just never, ever talk back to him. And so I never got any of my needs met that weren't what he felt they should be. And I think that last bit is key.
Interesting.
Like, he was defining her needs and then trying to meet them without actually consulting with her about what.
Never had her own agency.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like she blames him for it. Like, she kind of gets that, no, this was my growth path.
Right. She goes on to say, when I was young, it didn't make any difference because I was so crazy about him on so many levels. He was really everything to me. And after I had Chaz, I started to grow up and he wouldn't allow it. And I was starting to really, he was starting to kill my spirit. So, yeah, that's how Sonny Bono helped launch Cher into the stratosphere, but broke their marriage basically by being overbearing.
Yeah, don't marry a spirit killer. I mean, like, that's the, like, when you find the right one, like.
My guess is that in 64, in the fake Tijuana wedding, he was not yet a spirit killer.
Jeez.
But, like, he really was constantly looking for ways to build her profile. I mean, he created an LLC, basically, this was their business. Cher was their business, and his business, his business
mm-hmm.
was Cher Enterprises.
Wow.
That was the name of it. Ultimately, you know, he was working with a person and not a product and just couldn't listen. Like, if he were a sculptor and, like, oh, granite's not really working for me, let me try marble.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, marble's not, maybe bronze casting. Like, that's one thing. But he was sort of doing that with this human being who at the same time was his wife and, like,
Yeah,
just too much. So as a trash can rating,
I answer Galatea. Go ahead.
There's really no particular, like, drug use. There's
it's pretty vanilla.
And it seems like they went on to have a weird but warmish relationship. Cher eulogized Sonny beautifully when Mary Bono asked her to after his death.
Aww.
So I give it a 2. And I will also remind you that you will never get that time back if you do go and watch And the Beat Goes On, the Sonny and Cher story on YouTube. So, Sonny and Cher!
Stacey, that was...
Tear-free.
Nobody's getting loaded on too many cocktails. Nope. That was beautifully done.
Nobody's burning a hole in their septum.
Well done. My heart is not broken.
Nobody escaped across a dark interstate.
Podcast No Tears. A yeah. plus.
No, that
you
was...
You delivered on this week.
That was... Yeah, that was...
It was great.
It was more fun to research than the last one. Let me just put it
that
way.
Man, that was pretty vanilla. I dig it. I didn't know... So...
I knew very little of it.
Like, well done.
I just knew the broad brush stuff on that. I'm so glad that Sunny was not an abuser.
Yeah, right.
I would have been devastated. Cher is like 9 feet taller than he is.
That's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. All right, you want to take a break?
Let's take a break.
When we come back, we've got another... We have the happiest divorced couple in the world.
Possibly
They're not
so.
Exactly vanilla. They may be... chocolate rum marzipan like their wedding cake. But let's take a break and we're going to come back with legitimately the happiest divorced couple that's ever been divorced.
Perfect.
Do it.
I'm Elisa Lucas from Best Forevers, a podcast for kindred spirits. I'd like to start a movement where we spend more time loving on our friends because although friends are important to us, they're often in the shadow of other relationships. So if you want to love on your friendships a little bit more, embrace friendship a little bit more, or just appreciate your friendships a little bit more, then this podcast is for you. We'll explore all the different ways friendships take place, share the amazing stories of friendship, and discuss best practices for the difficulties that friends may experience. It's time to embrace friendships because without our friends, who would we be? So check out Best Forevers on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the other podcasting listening venues. And be sure to follow Best Forevers Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.
Alicia.
Stacey.
Alicia, you got the happiest split in splitdom?
This week.
The non-scandal of Christendom?
Oh my God, the non-scandal. Well,
I guess it was.
there is inherently a lot of scandal wrapped up in this.
Sure.
However, this week, I bring you the fairy tale romance of the happiest divorced couple in the world, Prince Andrew, Duke of York, and Sarah Ferguson. Duchess of York.
Red hair. I remember her from a certain period of the 90s.
I love her. I love her. Sarah, our bride, is just a little bit older than her Duke.
Oh, interesting.
She was born October 15th, 1959. She's a Libra. Andrew, born on February 19th. He's a Pisces.
Okay.
So this is an air and water mix, friends.
Okay.
What does it mean?
Very muggy.
They are well matched in enthusiasm, energy, and a desire for a sincere relationship. The good part about this mix is they tend to use their heart and their head together to make good decisions, which is contrary
to almost everyone else we've covered.
That's exactly. Apart, they are not that great at decision making, but when they're together, the air water mix will find that bond, and I think that will become apparent in this tale. You ready?
Is that why humidity makes hair frizzy?
You are so funny. Our Duchess, before she became a Duchess, was born the second daughter of Major Ronald Ferguson and Susan Wright. He retires from the military, British military, in 1968 when Sarah's about 11, and becomes the horse polo manager for Prince Philip.
The pony boy?
The pony boy for the Duke of Edinburgh.
What? Prince Philip, who is Elizabeth's...
Prince Philip, who is Elizabeth's...
The Queen's husband.
Correct. The Queen's consort.
Holy God.
He later becomes the pony boy.
This is a pony boy podcast.
To...
oh my God.
Charles.
Charles or to Mountbatten?
No, to Prince Charles.
Okay.
Sorry. But I'm sure he knew Mountbatten. And Mountbatten said it like,
pony boy, bring pony the steeds boy. Around.
So this connection, brings the Ferguson family into the royal circle.
Sure.
Where Sarah is first introduced to Andrew. They're all like hanging out as kids on the polo fields together on Saturdays because that's what you do.
Do you know if any of this happened? I forget the time period, but like that whole Sandringham, like Diana was playing with the young princes.
Correct.
Because they were all little kids together.
They're all,
Was Sarah part of that or was that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, Diana's coming in. Okay. They're friends.
Oh, I figured. I mean,
yeah, there's your the story
two,
has
two
everything.
Women who don't quite fit the royal household.
The story there has at the everything. Same time. So Andrew is the third child and the second son of Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. At the time of his birth, he is second in line to the throne. He is now seventh. He is said to kind of be the queen's favorite. There's something charming and fun and a little bit more real about him. And she has a real connection to this kid. Put a pin in that. Something really just the most charming thing I've ever seen the queen do is attached to that.
Aw.
So flying high in polo circles, like you do, Sarah's mom in the early 70s falls in love with a polo player named Hector Barrantes and inherits her famous nickname of the Bolter because as soon as Susan and Major sign their divorce papers in 74, Susan hightails it out of town and elopes with Hector to live in Argentina pretty much for the rest of her life.
Didn't Diana's mom bolt to Australia or something?
Yeah.
Which I did not know at the time. I told the story. I apologize. So, wow, what a bolty time.
Sarah finds out about her parents' divorce in the newspaper. Because it's a huge scandal. It's hitting the British press.
Right, but I mean,
she hasn't been told about any of...
Oh, God, that stiff upper lip thing. I'm guessing, right?
Well,
you don't talk about problems until they're problems.
Until they're in the Daily Mirror. Yeah. So Sarah, right, in the way awkward teenage years, remains on Dumberdown Farm in Hampshire with her dad and sister.
I'm sorry, Dumberdown?
Dumberdown.
Dumberdown! That's something in the South. That's what we call all of our farms.
In 1976, Major Ferguson remarries. New stepmom, three new children in rapid succession.
Well,
so her sister hightails it to Argentina. So Sarah's sort of like, So this is really doing a lot for her teenage self-confidence.
Wait, her sister or her mother?
Her mom does, but her sister does too.
Oh.
So Sarah's left with dad,
and
stepmom.
A bunch
the stepmom's
of babies.
Fine. Like, the new kids are fine, but she's like, what the fuck, man? So in your totally self-confident teenage years.
Yeah. When you're feeling great about yourself.
When you're feeling great about yourself. Like, poor Sarah. She recalls this is really when comfort food eating becomes a thing. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of other kids of divorce, she thinks the breakup is her fault.
Right.
This is also where she begins to build a shell around rejection and inclusion. Like she becomes an addict to being accepted and included and liked and part of the, because, right, you get it. It's the childhood that...
So like people pleaser kind of...
Absolutely.
Kind of set up.
I'm going to do whatever it takes to be liked and accepted.
That
because,
always works.
It's which the, will make for some problems
always
for
works.
Her before working this childhood trauma out. Like,
sure.
Hopefully everybody gets a chance to do. But she attends school. The staff describes her as courageous, bubbly, and an outgoing little girl. She excels at swimming and tennis. She's not a great academic student, but finishes a course at the Queen's Secretarial College and hightails it to London. Not changing any more diapers. She's going to work in an art gallery and becomes...
No more Dumberdown Farms.
Yeah, Dumberdown Farm, out. Hightails it to London, becomes reconnected with her BFF, Diana.
Oh,
and enters this little weird phenomenon called the Sloan Rangers. Do you know about the Sloan Rangers?
No. Tell me.
So the Sloan Ranger is a term that was adopted in the mid-70s to describe a stereotypical young middle-upper-class person who pursues a distinctive, fashionable lifestyle. So the term is coined after Sloan Square, this area of Chelsea, where this whole young up-and-comer, we kind of live on dad's money and being fashionable is the thing. I guess most equivalent for America would be like the preppy movement in the early 80s.
Right. And I'm guessing these are women who are working, but also sort of shopping for husbands at the time.
I mean, I mean, Diana's working in a nursery, for God's
sake.
Not that there's
anything wrong with wanting to get married, Jesus, but I know that it sounds terrible.
No, but they're all in the polo set. They're very horsey. They have family money. They have titles.
I mean,
or
her father is Pony Boy.
Right. Exactly. So Sloane Rangers are like kind of a thing in London culture.
That's
like
really
in sixth grade, we all wanted to be Sloane Rangers because that was about the time this was in my world.
Okay.
As an aside, not only women are in this club, male Rangers are called Hooray Henrys or Ra. He's a Ra.
The English are amazing.
I love them. So Sarah is Sloaning it up with her friend Diana, moves into public relations, goes to work for a publishing company. She has two fairly significant relationships. The first with Kim Smith Bingham, who is a stockbroker, and then more famously with Patty McNally, who is a motor racing manager 22 years her senior.
Can we back up?
Yes.
So
I figured we might need to.
Sloane Ranger, Sarah Ferguson at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Both of her heterosexual relationships are with a Kim and a Patty.
A Kim and a Patty. Yes.
It's wonderful and I love it.
Yes. It's perfect.
Okay. Just checking.
You got
just
it.
Checking in.
She lives with both men in these relationships.
Alleged men.
Which you should translate to not a virgin.
Sure.
Okay. So we know about like the...
It would be weird. It would be weird if...
So what is our fair hero up to?
Mm-hmm.
A little pub trivia for you. Prince Andrew is the first child born to a reigning monarch since the birth of Princess Beatrice in 1857 to Queen Victoria. So Queen Elizabeth II had Charles and Anne
while she was a princess.
Correct. She assumed the dynasty.
Fascinating.
Right? Which I think that's why there's a little like the queen just... He's cheeky and she loves him.
Oh, that does make sense.
He has a life of being looked after by governesses. And as you know, like, his mom's the queen. So he has an older brother, Charles, a younger brother, Edward, a sister, Anne. He's sent to all the right schools. Natch.
What? Really? I'm shocked.
Right. In 1973, enters Gordonston in northern Scotland, where Prince Philip and Charles went. He leaves with A-levels, but chooses not to go to university, but instead enters the Royal Navy.
If you tell me he goes to London to open a joke shop on Diagon Alley, right. I will be so happy.
No, not quite. Close. So close. He enters the Royal Navy.
Probably a better choice.
He enrolls at the Royal Naval College. He undergoes pilot training. He's accepted as a helicopter pilot. He signs on for 12 years.
Wow.
In 1979. So he is committed for 12 years to 1991, making this his career.
Wow.
Like, dude, he flies. He's dashing. He kind of does everything. Like, if it can actually leave the ground and fly, Andrew knows how to do it. He's kind of a badass.
All right.
So an insertion into the timeline here, just to set the stage. So... May 1979, Royal Navy, he's doing his thing. In 1981, at 21, Andrew is the best man at his brother's wedding.
To
Charles
and Diana.
So now that the pressure is off Charles, who does the pressure go to? So I want you to think about this for the next part. Also, Diana really wanted Sarah Ferguson as her lady-in-waiting, but that was vetoed by the palace in return for Jane Fellows, I believe. And instead, Sarah was on the front row.
Jane Fellows was her sister.
Yeah, but Jane Fellows was also married to someone in the palace.
No, yes. Like the queen's personal secretary or something.
Charge of papers and pens or something.
But I think it was Fellows who took Diana to Scotland for her first hangout with Charles. I could be wrong.
Well, Diana wanted Sarah.
Right.
Sarah instead is in the front row.
And the queen was like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Of Westminster with Diana's whole Sloane Ranger crew and her previous flatmates. So.
Okay. So I guess if you're putting on a royal wedding, you want to hand out those sort of like honorable.
Well, especially for the dynasty. Like the first son is.
Right.
By Andrew and Sarah's wedding, it was a little bit more loose and free form and
bit
more jovial than the. Right. Pressure of the first dynasty heir.
I was going to say, I mean, Charles was the heir, but that's kind of what I'm getting at is I can see that Diana's sister, the wife of someone on the palace staff would warrant higher consideration than one of Diana's buddies from the Sloane Rangers.
But I mean, it's cute to see her daughter on the front row.
Daughter of Pony Boy.
Well, hold on, it's gonna come back around.
Okay,
so picking back up the timeline, in 1982, Andrew also serves in the Falklands War. The palace is freaking out.
It's the one England won, though.
Yeah, so. Like the palace is like, it's fine. He wants to play helicopter pilot. That's cool. Like, go enlist in regular service, but participating in a real war? Nope. Get that kid to a desk job pronto.
Oof.
The queen insists he stays with the ship, which he does.
Good.
She steps in and she's like, no.
Good.
He signed on like, this is what he's going to do, and that's what he's going to do, and back off.
I know there was a lot of controversy about sending Harry to Iraq. I don't know how that was ultimately, I don't remember how that was ultimately decided.
Again, second son.
Sure, but I know at the time the fear was if the,
I think he actually saw like some duty. Like,
I think he did. But the fear was that if, you know, the enemy knew, oh, there's a royal in this unit.
Well, there, I didn't put it in, but it's tricky. Was an actual planned assassination, like not assassination, because he's not a political leader, but a hit on him.
I think it counts.
That was not acted upon or carried up, but it was planned.
Yeah.
Okay, so Andrew returns a hero.
Sidetracking, sorry.
He is also dating a lady at this time named Q Stark. Isn't that a great name? Q Stark.
Not real. Not real.
Totally real. She's an actress. She's a photographer.
Okay.
In 1982, they vacation in the Caribbean. Andrew's antics just endear him to the public. Q Stark gets an invite to meet the queen. And the press gets in on it. And then they start reporting that Q Stark had taken part in some pretty racy sex scenes in an R-rated movie in 1976 called Emily. Mm. Andrew broke off the relationship. Buckingham Palace was forced to awkwardly address the meeting between the monarch and the actress, saying, we do not know if the queen was aware of the girl's acting career before she was invited to Balmoral.
Let's go with probably not. Oh, Balmoral. So much has happened there.
So according to Lady Colin Campbell, Andrew was in love with Q, and the queen was much taken with the elegant, intelligent, and discreet Q. However, not going to happen in 1983. They split up under pressure from the press, paparazzi, palace. In 1988, Q Stark said, the amount of attention and pressure on me became unbearable. It was a nightmare. So to put this in perspective, everyone really likes her. The cycle's all just too much. Charles and Diana are brewing, right? The courtship, the marriage.
Sure.
Q and Andrew still do remain close. He is even the godfather to her first daughter. Like, I think everyone's just sad about it, but the wheel of pressure. So, pressure's on Andrew. Get married.
Yeah, I mean, I can't blame Q Stark.
He's brokenhearted. He's on the rebound. Pressure's on him. Here we go. Summer 1985. Diana reconnects Sarah and Andrew.
Oh, nice.
She remembers their childhood friends. And Diana suggests to the queen that maybe Sarah can come to Ascot this year.
Oh.
And the queen's like, Sarah Ferguson, I've loved that kid since she was 10. She is.
What a great idea.
Effervescent, and she's delightful, and she's just, I mean.
And my sweet Andrew's been a little mopey of late.
You know, Diana doesn't tell the queen it's a setup. Diana just suggests, like.
Hey, you know what? The queen is not stupid.
Yeah, the queen's not.
The queen is anything but stupid.
Your Majesty, that is correct.
She is 100 million years old and knows more. She has forgotten more than I will ever know. Wait,
so,
that's not a good thing to say.
Sarah goes to Ascot, which we've been by.
We have.
And Andrew and Sarah are seated next to each other at a luncheon. He remembers what fun she is, and he's looking to settle down. Not a lot of persuasion here to fall in love. They're both on the rebound. Her from Patty, him from Q, and this is sort of the beginning of a great romance. She loves his wit and charm. He is knocked out by her.
Nice.
I mean, I can imagine them having some pretty good sex. Like, just their... Like, he's called Randy Andy, for God's sakes. Like, he likes the ladies.
Sure.
And she is a fiery...
Sure.
Okay.
So they connect.
They connect like they're made for each other.
Okay.
They go to an Elton John concert together and they're not spotted.
Nice. Nice.
They go skiing with Charles and Diana together in Switzerland.
Okay.
Diana allows them to meet secretly at Kensington. Her matchmaking, total success. It's a love match. The queen is delighted. She loves Sarah and her refreshing nature. She great. Thinks this is going to be great. Prince Philip is not quite as taken. He does not like her because she knows the name of each and every member of the staff and servants and speaks to them, you know, like a normal person and chides her for flirting with the help.
Wow.
Prince Philip's a dick. I don't like that guy.
I feel, yeah. I've learned more about him since starting this podcast than I ever knew. And I feel like there's...
Can you imagine? I know the staff's name.
I feel like he is a dark figure.
Hey, Betty, how are you today?
Possibly nefarious.
Yeah.
Exactly
right.
How was
your event last night?
Oh, thanks for the towels, Sherry.
Thank you for asking, ma'am. Yeah, like, staff and servants are on guard not to commute.
Exactly.
What's wrong with, hey, Betty, how's it going today?
Right.
Anyway, makes no difference. They need the Queen's permission, not Prince Philip.
Right.
Based on the Royal Marriages Act of 1772, which
yeah,
is the recurring theme. As you can imagine, the press begins to stalk her hardcore. They brushed off all their gear from their Diana days.
Yeah, the,
go
the
to
hunt.
Town.
Yep.
It's hot news. Andrew's smitten. He proposes to Sarah on his 26th birthday.
Nice.
In February of 1986 in Scotland. With a ring he designed just for her, with 10 diamonds surrounded by a Burmese ruby, knowing ruby is the perfect stone for Sarah, and sets off her hair, and it's a beautiful ring.
Okay.
Their engagement was announced March 17th, 1986, so St. Patrick's Day, birthday St. Patrick's Day.
Nice.
The wedding date is announced for July 23rd, 86, and plans are aflutter. Okay.
Okay.
Here's the thing. This wedding and divorce are so well known. So sometimes in travel, like, you want to find the story that I'm telling you something that you maybe haven't heard everything about the story.
100%. Yeah.
But I have to talk about her dress.
Okay.
The entire country is like a little bit worried. Like, we like Fergie. She's a little frumpy, but we like her. But what the hell is she going to wear? Because she's a little frumpy. Her dress is a triumph. She loses about 25 pounds. It fits magnificently. It's a beautiful dress. Sarah uses bumblebees from her family crest and anchors for Andrew's career in the Navy, which are embroidered on the train of the dress. I posted a picture of it earlier this week on social. It's just beautiful. Their initials are embroidered into the train. She has four satin pearl S's for her and an A on the base of the train for his name.
These people were super in love, weren't they?
So,
I mean, you just
in
don't,
love, no.
You don't do that kind of detail stuff if you're not like...
I get chills. This is my favorite. This is my favorite divorce ever.
That's incredible.
Wink, wink. There's a surprise coming at the end. So designers had learned a little from Di's dress and left tulle, crinoline, anything that could wrinkle out of it, out of Sarah's dress. So she is in satin. So where Diana's dress got crushed after the carriage ride, Sarah emerges like a fucking rock star, right? Like, it is beautiful. She also, Sarah, reveals a little switch-up trick. So she comes in with a flower headband with gardenias and all these flowers that are very poignant to his lineage and her, like, blah, blah, blah. But she signs the actual paperwork. Once the paperwork is signed, where he's invested with the Duke of York and she's the Duchess of York, the veil flips back and there is her York tiara gifted to her by the Queen on the occasion of her marriage, which she does get to keep after the divorce.
Oh, nice.
The designer, here's something I didn't know. The designer made two dresses. This is apparently royal protocol for all brides, is that two dresses are made.
That seems like a smart...
I mean, you've got that much attention press, like, of probably going to do that.
Justin, I mean, that is not something where at the last minute you can...
Nope.
Yeah.
Well, and other brides have gone into the two-dress thing. More recently, Kate Middleton and Meghan Markle, with their dress for the ceremony is different than their dress for the reception. Totally fair. Sarah gets her backup. never uses it. Right now that dress is in Madame Tussauds.
Nice.
So you can go see its exact...
Sure. It's a little waxy now, but...
Duplicate. On their marriage day, he was invested with the title of Duke of York. She, Duchess. She is the 11th Duchess of York. Long, interesting line there. And I haven't told you that her nickname from the Sloan Ranger crowd for years has been Dutch.
Oh, no. No. Because I've always... Fergie.
No, Diana called her Dutch. Was Diane Dutch. Like, they were the...
That's so funny. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that funny?
That really is funny. Also, the pop star Fergie, it took me a long time to figure out that was not...
They're two distinct people.
I think that's true.
That is... I can verify for a fact that is true for you. So there are 500 million television viewers for the event. So a little bit less than Charles and Di.
Sure, but can
still...
half a billion humans tuned in. Well, and that's just sets. That's not counting the clusters of people in homes and bars and whatevers.
Yeah, no. It is a joyous...
half a billion...
buoyant occasion. Okay, here's the... I'm going to take a pen back out of the Queen and just him being her favorite.
Yeah.
My very... like, this is the best film of Queen Elizabeth II ever, is she's running after the carriage when they leave. Like, you get to see her literally skip along like a...
Oh, not to, like, get, but just out
like,
of
no,
joy.
When they're leaving for their honeymoon, they're like, I don't know, chase whatever tradition it is they're doing. But here's the queen skipping along like, this is about...
That's so lovely.
It's so lovely. They honeymoon for 5 days off the Azores Islands on the royal yacht Britannia.
Sure, they did.
And our couple is going to live happily ever after. Right?
Obviously, that's always how it works in royal couples, as we've demonstrated in our podcast, Trashy Divorces.
So remember, he's in active duty.
Yes.
And she works in publishing.
Okay.
And the press and the palace are not going to let this happen. They're like, you can't continue to have a job. You need to be a military wife. Maybe you can do some duties for us, but... you can't work. So he's gone. So what the hell is she supposed to do? Like, he's on active duty. He is gone all the time. For the duration of their marriage, they spend on average about 40 days of the year together.
Ouch.
40 days.
Like, from the start of their marriage? That's
no,
just
every
how,
year.
No, that's what I mean. But that's just how, like.
Yep. Every year, about 7 weeks and they're done. 7 weeks together per year with your spouse.
May I throw in a personal story?
Yes.
My grandfather and grandmother on my mother's side married on the eve of his going to World War II.
Oh, wow.
For the next, like, 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And their marriage never worked right.
It's tricky,
I mean,
right?
he would get shortly, like, he'd be able to come home a couple weeks a year or whatever. There were breaks in that, but basically the first 4 years of their marriage, they were not together, and it just never worked right.
It 7 weeks a year, like, no matter how strong or intense or deep your connection and how much of a love match it is, like, military families are pressed. Yeah. I get to see my spouse X amount of, like, that is fucking tough to do.
Yeah.
Now put the palace, the press, the pressure of royal engagements. Like,
right.
You've got this whole other, like, you're supposed to be in a fucking PR firm.
Right.
Married to your husband who's on active duty. So I'm going to do my job and write you letters every day and love you and love the 7 weeks we have together. So what does Sarah do? She's going to have some babies and do some royal duties. The couple become parents on August 8th, 1988, with the birth of their daughter, Beatrice Elizabeth Mary. But to back up the bus on that, I always know and celebrate Princess Beatrice's birthday. Not only because it's one day after mine, but look at the numerology. She's 8-8-1988. It is so cool. Like, I have another friend born on 8-8, but 8-8-1988?
I mean,
incredible.
What could be better?
I love it.
8 is great.
So the couple goes on official tours, and they at least get to spend time together. Their second child, Princess Eugenie, is born March 23rd, 1990. The press is brutal to Sarah about her baby weight, and that sucks. Like, come on. I'm having kids here, and get off my ass about how much I weigh, and have you seen the damage you're doing to my sister-in-law? So he's away, and the brutality of the press really does turn full mass on her, and it's bad. But she's a trooper. She wants love and acceptance. She's a child of divorce, right?
Yes. The Bolter, yes.
But by 1991, the marriage is in trouble. And Sarah is really just kind of unable to deal with her husband's duties because he's gone for so long and the couple's drifting apart. And I get it. But Andrew's away. And she starts being seen in the company of other men like Texas millionaire Steve Wyatt.
Isn't his duty over? Isn't his 12-year stint up in 91?
Yeah. So, like, he's a but it falls apart before he can come back. Yeah. But not really, because hold on. Okay. So, like, the press is riling up everything they can. In March of 1992, the couple announced their intention to separate. It's very amicable. Like, they really do love each other, but it's just not working. Charles and Di also announced their separation this year.
Right.
It was the anus horribilis for the queen, 1992.
It was a horrible anus that year.
It was, I mean, it was just like, it was a bad year.
Yeah.
Following the separation, the palace announced that Sarah would no longer carry out public engagements on behalf of the queen. And the queen said that she would not take responsibility for Sarah's debts. So they're amicably separated. They're working out terms. They still have two young children, but, you know, things are okay. So August of 1992 rolls around. And there's Sarah, sunbathing topless on holiday in the south of France with John Bryan, who is a financial manager and an American, no less.
Notably not her husband. Okay.
Not her husband. Her child is there. There's some toe kissing.
Oh.
There's some hugging.
You're saying there may have been a little bit more where there were not cameras? Who can say?
No, these are, you're shooting me from,
I know,
half a mile away, and I think I'm on holiday with
right.
explicit privacy, and I am separated from my husband, and go right. fuck right off. But these 10 photos are published in the Daily Mirror, and all hell breaks loose. This is the coup de grace. Like, it's too much. These photos come out when the Queen and Prince Philip are on their own holiday at Balmoral, their favorite summer holiday in Scotland when it's nice and pleasant. So there's a lot of time to stew about this.
Yeah.
Prince Philip has never forgiven Sarah for this, for disgracing them. Never, not once. Like,
he doesn't seem like a big forgiver.
No. Fergie writes in her memoir, "It would be accurate to report that the porridge was getting cold." She remembers the morning that the newspapers were delivered, eyes wide and mouths ajar. The adults were flipping through the Daily Mirror and the rest of the tabloids. I had been exposed for what I truly was, worthless, unfit, a national disgrace. Like, she is, and this starts, like, she's going to have a good, like, it's good, but it's.
Yeah, but it's
this is really a chink in her.
The blink moment.
Maybe there's some things I need to recognize about. Mm-hmm. She didn't get there quite yet, but this is definitely a... So the royal family is scandalized, and they just begin to heap massive amounts of shame. Princess Margaret, the Queen's sister, writes to Sarah, "You have done more to bring shame on this family than could have ever been imagined." Which, okay, shit. This was podcast, no tears.
Yeah, well...
These photos end all hope at reconciliation...
Except.
Well, their separation lasts another 4 years. They're definitely headed for divorce.
Right.
There's a little controversy about how the details shuffled out. They do share custody of their children. Sarah says the palace gave her £15,000 a year in the settlement. Further details say they gave her a lump sum of $3 million. So, like, $3 million doesn't seem like any really significant amount of money for a family that has a lot of it. She does lose the Her Royal Highness. She keeps Duchess of York. If she remarries, she would lose that. But why would she? Because she's in love with her ex-husband, and he loves her. And here's where I think it's the greatest love story of all time.
To be clear, this is something you're pretty sure is true, but is not necessarily...
100%. I believe this with all my heart.
Okay.
My research tells me it is.
It's your supposition, though. It's not a documented
fact. This is a speculation warning. Speculation warning.
Gotcha.
The Duke of York speaks fondly of his former wife. "We have managed to work together to bring our children up in a way that few others have been able to, and I'm extremely grateful to have been able to do that." In the following years, Andrew and Sarah are both embroiled in some scandals independently. Sarah, it's bad, gets involved in this cash for access scandal. And she says to Oprah, hold on. So she authors books and kids books and is a spokesperson and does a show for Oprah that Dr. Phil's on that made a lot of impact, because this is when she really begins to break down some of those internal structures.
Kind of remember
that lead her to start making better decisions. So yeah. She seems to have found herself. This whole cash for access previous to this intervention was pretty bad.
Was this cash for access to the royal family?
Yeah, Andrew and the royal family.
Again, it's funny because that's apparently not a problem at all in the United States these days.
Trashy divorces. I gotta stick to the story, but there's so much. Mm-hmm. She says, I was so out of control with desperation where I'd reached the point of no return. There aren't really many words to describe such an act of gross stupidity. Sarah and the palace insisted that Prince Andrew had been unaware. Andrew goes to mom and Prince Andrew helps mitigate some of her debt. And Sarah writes that her daughters are actually grateful for that entrapment, as it saved Sarah from her spiral downward and sort of makes a change in how she begins making some different decisions. I love her and she's plucky. And I think their head and heart aspect of their relationship did lead to some stupid decisions personally for them. But as a couple, okay, just imagine they're royal. They can't have a normal marriage. And hey, maybe they both want to swing a little. And the press is awful. He's fucking Randy Andy, for God's sakes. And she's a fiery hothouse. And they really love each other. And how do we maybe make a compromise to make this work? The Duchess continues to live at the Duke's home, Sunning Hill Park, until 2004, when he goes to the Royal Lodge. Sarah, in 2007, purchases Dolphin House next door to the Royal Lodge. That house catches fire. She moves into the Royal Lodge. So they have been living together as long as they've ever been divorced.
Sorry, are you accusing Sarah of arson of the Dolphin Lodge?
No.
I was joking, but I love your...
No.
That is two hands held high with a no.
What I'm saying is they got divorced and they have lived together consecutively since they have been married.
Sure.
Except since for when they weren't married, when they only spent 7 weeks.
Right.
Since they've been divorced, they've been married, for God's sakes.
Right. Which is one way to really cut out the in-laws from running your life.
It's the smartest.
You're not the boss of me.
Not the boss of me.
Queen. I mean, you're the
queen. I don't want to do royal engagements. I don't want the press to be on me because I wore leggings to go get fucking milk from the grocery store.
Right.
Get off my ass. Like, okay. I mean, in 2015, Sarah assumes residence in Switzerland. She and the Duke of York own a £13 million chalet there together. She applies for Swiss residency. She maintains an apartment in Eaton Square, London, and a room at Andrew's house at Royal Lodge. Crazy. Since the divorce, Sarah does attend some functions with her daughters, such as the investitures of Duke of York into the Royal Victorian Order, Order of the Garter, and Royal Ascot. On these occasions, she is afforded the courtesy of treatment as a member of the royal family. In the Diamond Jubilee guidelines, they mention her as being a member of the royal family. Sarah even hinted in 2013, like, she hints at the idea of remarrying him in interviews.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. In August 2013, Sarah is invited to stay at Balmoral with Prince Andrew and their daughters as guests of the Queen. In September 2013, in response to a question about the possibility of remarrying Andrew, she says, he's still my handsome prince. He'll always be my handsome prince.
Okay, that's really sweet.
Sarah was not invited to the 2011 wedding of William and Catherine, but does attend the wedding of Harry and Meghan Markle. She does not get an invitation to the later party by Charles. And apparently she's deeply upset by that, but she gets it. She's divorced from the family, but not divorced from him.
Right.
Like, she doesn't spend Christmas with her girls for 15 years because they're at Balmoral in Scotland with the Queen. Like,
right.
She has definitely made a trade-off for this arrangement. The Queen tolerant as she is, eventually mends her relationship with Sarah. Like, Sarah talks really fondly of the queen. She's steadfast to her. She's known the queen since she was 10 and has sort of
Right. Like, they've gone on this journey together.
They've gone on this journey together. Yeah. She's older. She's wiser. Eugenie's wedding to Jack Brooks Bank last year, October of 2018, kind of brings it all back around. Sarah is the highlight of the day.
Really?
Yeah. Like, because there she's the mother of the bride.
Oh.
This is at Windsor,
okay,
right?
Okay. I'm like, who is Eugenie? Of course.
Their daughter.
Great.
Fergie. I love this. Brings the same Milano Blahnik bag to Eugenie's wedding that her mother, the Bolter, brought to Sarah's wedding. And in that bag, her mom passed away in 98. A car accident. It's bad. But her mom had been gone a long time, but I guess she got some of her mom's things.
Sure.
So when she goes to that bag, looking through, she finds the admission tickets to her own wedding in it, which are also of the color green. So green bag, green tickets. That's why Sarah decided to wear green that day to the wedding. I love vintage bags, and it's just so
I know
cool.
You do.
She and Andrew are just present this very united front, and they're as happy as ever. And this is my favorite trashy divorce. I think this couple has found a way to live their best life with each other, and they really are a love match. And good for those crazy divorced kids. The happiest divorced couple around. I love them.
Wow.
Podcast Almost No Tears. I love her.
Does this have a trash can rating? Or you came up with something different for Margaret Mitchell. Like Halos? Was it Halos?
No, I mean, nobody.
There's some trash. I mean, there's a little bit of trash here.
I have left out a number of other. But toe sucking.
Sure. Yeah. On the South.
But there's still. I don't know. We got to give it a something, because otherwise it'd be a wash and we wouldn't put it on the...
Sounds like it can't go above a two. It doesn't
sound... 1.5.
Okay.
Like, I love them. They're my favorite divorce couple in the world, because they're still together.
Right. I mean, that's what's... And again,
and they've
with...
just found a way to... You know what? No fucking judgment. Don't pass your judgment on a relationship. We can have the relationship that we want to have. Again, listeners, this is all speculation. I do not know if this is true at all, but...
Sure.
It just, okay, many of you feel the same way. I know you do, because we have talked about it. Like, it's a thing. We're all rooting for them. Wouldn't that be amazing? Like, I don't know if they'll ever get married.
Well, again. But so sort of the inverse, like imagine that Sonny and Cher had remained married. Mm-hmm. Cher's career would not have gone in the direction it did. And it seems likely that Sonny Bono would never have gone to Congress, because she wouldn't have... I mean, Cher is a big, like, gay rights activist. Mm-hmm. She was not going to let her husband run as a Republican for anything.
Fuck.
But divorced, she could be completely supportive of her ex-husband running for Congress as whatever he wants to be.
That's Sarah and Andrew.
Yeah.
You
I mean,
what?
That's...
It's,
yeah.
We can support each other, but, like, the pressure is
We can
off.
Only be who we are separately. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were actually separate, unlike potentially.
So they've... been happily in love and living together since their divorce.
They've been happily unmarried for a few decades now.
It's the most amazing love story ever.
That's cool. That's very cool.
So there's your trashy divorces with a twist.
I hope that the story you have told is close to the true, like, actual thing that's happening in their lives. That would be beautiful.
It's our dream. It's my dream.
Yeah.
I mean, speculation warning, but... I would love it if the story really was exactly what I think the story is.
No, it would be beautiful. I hope it is. I hope it is.
So there is our episode 11, Trashy Divorces, Redemption Week. No hard liquor needed. No Kleenex needed, except for the host.
Well.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in.
Thank you. We'll talk to you next week.
Keep it trashy.
Keep it trashy. Although it doesn't, our subjects didn't, so. Maybe you don't have to either.
Toe sucking in the
keep
Riviera.
It trashy.
Yeah, come on. I mean, it's credit where credit's due. Keep it a little trashy. Cheers, friends. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Trashy Divorces is a Hemlock Creatives production.
Our music is by Ratsy.
You can find her on Instagram at Ratsy's Store.
Our art is by Sydney V. Smith.
You can find her art at sydneyvsmith.carbonmade.com.
We are on all kinds of social media.
At Trashy Divorces, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
We're on Patreon.
Holy cats, are we on Patreon?
We sure are.
Find some super fun bonus content there.
Totally.
Tell a friend about Trashy Divorces.
Like, rate, review.
And if you have communication for us or are desperate to tell us your near and dear trashy divorce, send us email to
trashydivorces@gmail.com.
Man, that's the outro business.
We've made it pretty easy.
Keep it classy, friends.
Don't take trash candy from strangers.